I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with a global attitude in the subway this hour at a time when you want to hear oracles, not experts. There are no experts on exactly what the United States is going through in this pre-presidential season. Amber, you're one of our oracles. Amber, famous talk show caller. I call her the uninvited guest, the undocumented witness at the great banquet table of American life, sees all, forgives much, but not all. Out of the audience yesterday, Amber, a listener in New York sent me an email, said, give me Amber or give me death. You listen on your own frequency. Tell us what is going on in America today. In politics, between races, in this churn around particularly the Democratic presidential nomination, around Barack Obama, what's happening?
Well, just my little point of view sitting on the subway. I've been thinking about this, I admit that, thinking about it quite a bit. It's back to my horizons, back when I was a little girl, growing up in an island really far away from here. Little British island called Barbados. Every day I'd go down to the edge of the water and stare way out at that horizon. And I was convinced at age 5, America was just over that edge. Terrifying, electrifying, important, deep, epic, beautiful, monstrous. That's what America was to me, still is. And so much of this campaign, so much of this man is wrapped up in that once again. I'm almost, don't get excited, almost a born-again American today. It's not that I'm in love or in awe with Barack Obama. It's what his moment on the American stage means for this country, for the world, for me, for all of us.
Amber, I've never heard you so, I don't know what, so effusive. Enchanted, so effusive, so on the verge of a big political romance. You're always kicking the tires unmercifully. And here you are, almost born again.
Now you're in trouble. No romance, no enchantment. Amber doesn't do romance or enchantment. And I repeat, it is not him. It is what he represents. It is his moment. It is the idea of a second chance for what I believe for this place. This, whatever this is, this country is my religion. It is what I believe in. It is what I have fed on from the time I was young enough to look at a map on the blackboard of my classroom at 5 years old and see something that said America, stretching from Canada to South America. And it finally dawned on me as this kid with a great-grandfather from Scotland who couldn't speak an English that, you know, anybody understood, to a grandmother from Panama, who was more native than she ever was Spanish. Finally, you know, that word America meant I belong somewhere. This is my decade, my century, my universe, my existence. And this man who is, yes, black, but certainly not what Americans mean when they scribble down black American. Certainly he is African from his father, but certainly not what you all traditionally mean by African American. This is the mutt. This is me. This is what your country is supposed to be. This is what every little baby born out there with an Egyptian father and an Irish mother or an Irish grandfather is. He is us. And it's not enchantment. It's sort of, finally, at long last, an American comment on the world stage that means something. Something. It's not just about us. It's about those people in London being bombed in trains. Those people in Madrid being bombed in trains. Those people in Baghdad being bombed in trains. Who all look at him and his name confuses them, his background confuses them, and yet they can identify with this moment in our history. Do I think we'll end up finishing this sentence the way I want to see it ended? Well, I'll give you one hint. John Mack McCain. No, I don't think we'll get the ending. But at least we got the promise again of what this place is and is supposed to be and what it has meant to all those, you know, starry-eyed fools like me who don't look at morning in America but keep looking at that horizon. God, how I hate and love and am tormented by that horizon that this man is the promise of.
Okay, before we get to the end, say more about where we are. And what's to say about this country? You love it and love to knock it. That has turned on a dime, it feels. It's hot. From George Bush twice to the man from Kenya and Kansas, a completely different spirit. How does this country do it? You gather from abroad, even Davos, where the big money guys gather and compare notes. They marvel at this country. How did it turn?
It isn't. This is who we really are. This is who we've always been. And by we, I'm including, yes, me and all the rest, you know, all those people scrambling across that border this morning between Mexico and Los Angeles, because they're Americans too. And they're Barack, and they see him. They see themselves in him. You know, this is who we've always been. And this is what this country is supposed to be and what it does best. At its most important, the reason why so many people go to their passport office in downtown, you know, Islamabad and Havana and Moscow is because they want what you're seeing on the stage right now. That notion of, yeah, I am an American. There's always a turning on a dime. There's always a reinvention. There's always that moment for religion and hope and everything else. And to take nothing away from Hillary Clinton, because it is equally important that there is someone wearing a skirt on the stage next to him, fighting tooth and nail. But this is why, you know, we didn't need bombs to stop the Taliban. We needed to remind the world of what we are. And what we are is in these two individuals standing on the stage going, this is what America really is. And for someone who hasn't seen it in years, for someone who's missed it and ached for it, I cannot begin to tell you how scared and terrified and yet deliciously happy I am for all of the ugliness that has gone with it, that this moment is here.
Is Hillary over entirely?
Yes. There's no more to say on that sentence. Yes. Absolutely. She is. It's done.
Was it something she did?
Well, you know my theory, Chris. I blame you and your friends in the media. No, I just don't think that this was ever going to be her moment. I just don't. I think, in a sense, she was sort of the opening sentence to what Barack hopefully will finish. Was she needed? Yes, believe it or not. I think it was important. I cannot imagine that Edwards versus Barack or any other Democrat would have been this significant to me. There was something important about seeing Bill, who told me not to think about tomorrow, basically scrambling not to leave the stage as the man who is actually thinking about tomorrow takes the stage. It made it that much more poignant to me. I got it. It was like, yeah, I remember, Bill. I remember you told me that, but you never did deliver that tomorrow, did you? Too busy with Monica. Now, thank you. I think just maybe we can finally, as a country, grow up and start building that tomorrow that you saw but couldn't quite deliver.
What is the Kennedy... the Kennedys have leapt onto that bandwagon with a huge thud or something. What does that tell you? Are they leading the wave or following it?
Following. Now you want Amber the cynical to return. I admit I'm tired of names like Reagan and Kennedy. Unless the name is Robert Kennedy, I no longer care. I realize the media is obsessed with the fact that Ted and company endorsed Barack. It means nothing to me, and I suspect it means nothing to most of my generation. What else were they going to do? What possible other option did they have? Even the Kennedys sitting in their walled compounds holding on to their past can realize that whether he wins, lose, or draws, this is a significant moment. Their endorsement meant nothing. Absolutely. If anything, I was more comfortable when he wasn't being endorsed by the big names of the Democratic Party, because it sort of meant that, yeah, this was we the people endorsing Mr. Barack. Now, of course, we the people may decide, as I keep warning you, that we endorse Mr. McCain much more. Go ahead. Here.
You mean you bet on McCain?
Yes, believe it or not. Picture the race come when this is over. You have one young man coming from a history of a country where once upon a time the likes of him were not allowed on that stage, saying, look at the horizon, think about tomorrow, sit down, Mr. Clinton, tomorrow is here. You have a man who can sit there and say, I've been there in those cages. Remember that? I was born in America once upon a time, that young Republican conservative male sent off to the last war you did not know how to fight. We're in the middle of a war right now that we don't know how to lose. Not win, how to lose, because we are losing it. And we have no idea what the consequences are. Or maybe we're just afraid of the consequences because they are far more serious than any war we've ever lost. John McCain can sit on the stage next to Mr. Barack and say, I've been in this war before. Not quite this virgin, but I know how to handle this. You're telling me that at the end of the day, America's going to choose the African-American, maybe he is, maybe he isn't, male over, I've been there, done that. In times of crisis, this country learnt under Reagan to run back to its past, that warm, comfortable place in the 1950s where life was allegedly calm and mom stayed and baked you cookies. It will be interesting to see if this time we can take a leap of faith and go, okay, Mr. Barack, we're going to go with you to that horizon. Go ahead, you can be our Captain Picard. Take us into that horizon. Take us into that unknown world. We're going to trust you. Or will they go back to Mr. McCain and go, for God's sake, protect us from those alleged bombs that are coming our way? That is the question of this election. I do not have an answer yet. But something tells me, with enough spin doctors and enough warnings of Al-Qaeda to come over the borders, Mr. McCain just might pull this off.
Hmm. What do you see happening in... Amber, you watch white America. Amber, you know white America much better than white America knows you. What about that 25% almost of the South Carolina Democrats who voted for Barack Obama? What's happening in white America as you register it?
White America. Redemption's a beautiful thing, even in the color white, Mr. Leiden. Don't you know that by now? Everybody wants a taste of salvation at some point. Perfectly honest with you, I shouldn't say white America. After a while, you stop being white, black, pink, green when you realize your son or your daughter might be dead in the city of New York or Washington or Los Angeles or even somewhere in Charlotte. Simply because the man you elected, because he was a good old white boy who made you feel like you could have a bear with him someday, has managed to screw up their future. Eventually, they are people who get you beyond the color line. And if you listen to Mr. Barack's speeches, again, this is not an endorsement of Barack. This is an endorsement of what he stands for. Even white America, no matter how red the neck is, still wants to believe in something bigger than just that redneck. They still want to believe in America. They still want to believe those horizons aren't going to be about their dead sons and daughters because they simply went as a tourist to the city of New York one summer. That's what this ultimately is. We can almost thank Mr. Bush and the fear he's created for this moment, because as Americans, we don't like to be afraid. It's not who we are. It's not what built this country. And here comes along this young man, you know, he's the right color to be afraid. He's the right race to be afraid. He should be making certain comfortable southern lat folks afraid. But he doesn't, because he doesn't talk about fear. He talks about, you know, the future, us, and what else? Hope and unity.
Amber, you made a remarkable statement to me 5 years ago, maybe, when you said you didn't want the Democrats to win in 2004 because Bush should clean up his own mess. And I said, this country could be unrecognizable after 4 more years of Bush. And you said, Chris, it is unrecognizable. I often wonder how you have made it through these years, past the Patriot Act, past the immigration folk. How is it these days for you? Have you ever run afoul the security or the immigration police? I mean, have they ever pulled you over?
So far, no. And you live second to second with that fear now. Used to be hour to hour. Now it's minute to minute, second to second. A couple of weeks ago, they had the Diary of Anne Frank on a local channel. Turned it on, started watching. Never seen it, read it, but never seen the movie version. The second they show you human beings locked in a attic, terrified of their own society, I could not continue to watch. Mm. And that is not normally me. And something about that moment, just the idea of hiding from the world you belong to, the life you believe in, I just could not handle. I live with certain guilts. Guilts like, I want to be a tax-paying, voting, obnoxious, good old-fashioned American. It's what I want. It's what I've always wanted. Mm. I can outlive the Patriot Act. I can't outlive my belief that this little experiment is something important. I can outlive George Bush. I can outlive anti-Americanism. Because for some reason, which I will never understand, but drives me here, I will always believe somewhere around the corner there's yet another American comment that's going to be important and that I want to be a part of.
I'm also wondering what it's like day to day, getting in and out of City Hall or the post office or paying the bills, paying the rent, navigating the subway.
An act of beautiful defiance. An act of Christian belief. An act of Islamic belief, if you choose to believe that. I don't like answering my telephone because I don't know who's on the other end. I don't like walking into post office because I don't know what I'm going to be asked for. The scariest word in the English language is show me your ID. I don't go out with friends for drinks because you have to show an ID in bars. I'm terrified of that phrase. Where before, you know, every stranger was just a stranger, now every stranger is an informant. Will I slip up? Will they ask me questions like, do you drive? I hate that question because everybody drives. And so when I say no, then of course comes the follow-up, why not? So, yeah. And yet, I sit here probably the least angry I've been, even though the last 4 years have been the worst of my existence here. I sit here the least angry I've been because I refuse to give up what I believe into the Patriot Act. I refuse to give up what I believe into Pat Buchanan. I refuse to give up what I believe into Dick Cheney. And hopefully, just hopefully, you know, nothing happens and I'm still standing here in the place that I love and adore and worship the way you do, your own body, your own soul, just a little longer. I'm going to die and be buried here, damn it, Chris, just to teach the Patriarch a lesson.
John McCain was your friend on the immigration issues. Do you want to give him the tip of the hat or not?
I give him considerable tipping of the hat for that, but when you sort of catch this disease called Americanism, because it is an illness. It's like a fever under the skin. You have no idea because you were born here. You do not know what it does to me just to turn on a television and see Mickey Mouse. You get all warm. Oh my God, America. Love and hate this place. You know, it's the curse of every immigrant. You just go, oh yes. You walk down the street and the flag is waving some morning that, you know, Osama just released his latest tape. And you go, oh, curse this country. And then the next breath you go, love this country. You cannot get away from it. I have considerable respect for Mr. McCain for getting that issue. But the disease of Americanism is I care more about all the other issues just as equally as I care about myself. And John McCain is not the man for the American moment right now. And I do not want him elected president simply because he might make my life personally better. That is not what this place has ever been to me. It's far more important that we have someone who, like I said earlier, some little boy in Tel Aviv, some little boy in Kenya, some little boy in Palestine is going to wake up, turn on his little television in his kitchen and go, oh my God, is that what America really is?
Where are you getting your news these days, and who out there in media land understands what's going on?
Should we call Chris Matthews for dinner? No. you know my opinion of the press, Chris. I've been doing the same thing I always do. I read them, I watch them, and then I don't believe a word they say, and that hasn't changed in 4 years. Is the press in awe of Barack Obama? Yes, but that only makes me feel as though how sad and pathetic that they finally got what the rest of us have known for years. I still don't believe them. I still don't trust them. I read Maureen Dowd, and I read her ranting and raving about Billary, and it you know, it never fails to amaze me that Maureen Dowd doesn't get that she's She's part of Villery. She practically is the third person in their marriage. That's what the press never seems to realize. The press is trying to take this moment away from us and make it about them and Bubba's peccadilloes once again. And most of us, thank God, are ignoring them, which is what you should do with the media, with all due respects to my fine, wonderful friend here. Read them. And it never fails to depress me how few Americans do read newspapers or turn on the nightly news. Read them, turn them on, and then sit there and force your brain to think the opposite. You know, thinking is an active and painful exercise, but try it. You get addicted to it. So pick up the New York Times, read it, and then turn around and go, yeah, but I'm smarter than Maureen Dowd, whether she knows it or not.
Amber, you're in rare form. Thank you. Keep thinking. Keep your eye on us, will you?
Absolutely. Eye on that horizon, Chris. Eye on that horizon.
What's really happening at the surface and under it feels like upheaval, rapture, rise, fall, surely change, as they say. Bronze in Alabama, you're one of my oracles. And let's preserve some of the veil around your identity. I know you from the radio audience. You've always been wise, ahead of the game. How would you describe yourself?
As an entrepreneur with insight.
Okay. How would you describe this moment, Bronze?
Well, as an African American, this is possibly the birth pangs of the dream. I think it really is an epiphany, Chris. When I look at young African-Americans think about what Barack Obama means to them, there's a hopefulness that is in their eyes that I had not seen for a long time. There's an understanding of why you should do well in school. There's an understanding of why it is important to carry yourself, to attire yourself in a particular way. Barack Obama has connected the idealism and what individuals think that youth should be doing and has made it real for young people. I think that's what's happening to him. I think that the dark cloud of just sadness and desperation because you just can't get there being a good guy has been disproved by Barack Obama. He is a good guy, and he is making it. He is kind of the Todd Clifton of America now. Todd Clifton from The Invisible Man.
Explain Todd Clifton and remind us of Invisible Man. Some said the greatest novel of the 20th century in America, Ralph Ellison's portrait of himself in struggle in Harlem from the South in the 40s into the 50s. Who is Todd Clifton and how in the world does he reappear in this century as Barack Obama?
Well, Todd Clifton was a Harlem activist, and he operated as a sort of Marxist loyalist in the story. But eventually he became a person who tried to fight joblessness amongst the youth, was a black nationalist, and was interested in the progressive hope characteristic of the Invisible Man from the second half of the book on into the future. He was the symbol of hope in Ellison's mythology. And I think that Barack Obama is that person in real life come to be. It was almost as if Barack Obama was prophesied when Ellison said his famous lines, "Who knows but that on the lower frequencies I speak for you." And I think that Obama is speaking for those on the lower frequencies, those who have not had opportunity, those who have not had an opportunity to demonstrate what they can do. I think he's demonstrating that he can do. And I think that's really impacting white America, saying, hey, you know, we need to be a little more proactive, those of us who believe, because if this guy can do it, then we're really, really underutilizing a lot of talent.
Bronze, I'd love to hear you invoke Ralph Ellison, because not only is a new biography that sets him in the context again, but he was above all an American voice who thought black Americans were Americans above all. He was named after Ralph Waldo Emerson. He believed mightily in the omni-American, the universal experience of this country.
And I hadn't connected that with Barack Obama before.
Well, Ellison had a real issue finding how he was going to transition from his time into the future.
Hmm.
Many young activists personally did not understand what Ellison was talking about.
He came to be seen as very conservative.
As very conservative, but it was very much like Miles Davis. When Miles Davis became electric, most of his peers did not understand that. If Ellison had, quote-unquote, gone electric, he was afraid that his peers would not understand that.
Hmm.
And so he decided to stay where he was. He was confounded. Unfortunately, many black thinkers, young black thinkers at that time, castigated him, thinking he was a, quote-unquote, Uncle Tom. But he wasn't. He just did not know how to make it through. In his book, The Invisible Man, Todd Clifton was his hope for making it through. I believe Barack Obama is a real-life Todd Clifton, a real omni-American, an individual neither defined by race or education or any of these sort of externalities, but an individual, as Dr. King said, who the content of his character defined him.
Yeah, I'm fascinated that you mentioned Miles Davis. Connect Barack Obama with African-American culture, the expressive culture, musical and otherwise.
Well, the one thing that's interesting about about Barack Obama and his similarities and differences with Miles Davis is that they're both innovators. Miles, a musical innovator. Barack, a political innovator. I mean, there isn't anything that's much more innovative than a left-wing Democrat calling attention to the impact of the Reagan years on American society.
Hmm.
Some Democrats are not ready for that innovation, just like some individuals were not ready for Miles Davis to move to electrified piano and electrified horns and electrified guitars. No, they weren't ready for that, and neither are many traditional Democrats ready for the innovations culturally and politically for Barack Obama. And this is what is so important. Obama is changing not only the tone in American politics, but by proxy, the tone in American business, the tone in American education, the tone in American art, the tone in American foreign policy, by saying there is no need to be antagonized. And this is where Barack Obama was different than Miles Davis and different than Jesse Jackson and different than Al Sharpton. Not only is he not antagonizing, but he is not antagonized.
Hmm.
And this makes a real difference in the views of whites, especially.
Spell out the implications in, say, education or foreign policy, too.
Well, I think the implications in education are this, that individuals are not definable by any externality. Hence, the expectations of black people for black children will change because they see the project they're in. I think the implications for foreign policy, again, is that maybe everyone in America is not a cowboy. Maybe everyone in America does not believe in shoot first and ask questions later. Maybe we've come to a time when the American is as collaborative and engaged with the rest of the world as we used to be isolationist and closed off from the rest of the world. This may be the only way for us to hold our position in the world as a nation that leads with hope as opposed to forces with fear.
Bronze, you've always been interesting in our many radio conversations. How did you become an Obama person?
I was driven to it.
How so?
I was driven to it. Initially, I had been a Clinton acolyte, and I supported she and him by proxy because they had done yeoman-like service for the American culture society. Whether or not you agree with them or not, I believe that they were really trying to help. And for me, I wanted to attempt to stick with those individuals. As the famous saying goes, you dance with who what brung you.
Hmm.
But when Mr. Clinton began attacking, President Clinton began attacking Mr. Obama and implying that he is a race-limited character, that he is a politics of race, was his view. That's all he was talking about. He drove me from him and from his wife because of it. It was pure nastiness.
When he said, for example, that, oh, well, Jesse Jackson won the South Carolina primary twice in the 80s, dismissing him. Is that what you mean?
Right. Well, the implication was that any old Negro can win a primary in South Carolina, as opposed to this individual has now won two primaries, leads in actual votes, leads in actual delegates, and if you had to pick a front runner, was a front runner. Unfortunately, the edge and the tone of his rhetoric was such that it was dividing and would eventually end the great coalition of Northeast liberals and Southern African Americans that has worked on occasion effectively for the Democratic Party since the time of Kennedy.
What did it do to white America, do you think?
Well, I believe for those so-called white liberals, the white people who supposedly understand, one of the things that many of them did not understand was the actual insidious nature of race baiting. And I believe that in the political conversations that we've just observed with the South Carolina primaries is that they themselves saw the race baiting, the implication, the destruction by implication, the sidestepping snideness, which is the patent tool of any racial attack.
Interesting. I was fascinated, Bronz, that the white press, the New York Times especially in the lead, called Bill Clinton and all this. I mean, he is generally seen now to have embarrassed himself.
Well, let me say this about Bill. The thing about Bill is that Bill has never been challenged. No one has ever challenged him on his wrongness. And he does not feel the need
to
accept.
A Republican Senate impeached him, right?
Right, but that's like a Ku Klux Klansman saying he doesn't like my haircut. Why am I listening to that? And neither did he. But when it comes from your own backyard, it might be time for a trim. And Bill Clinton has been trimmed back. He's been trimmed back by the Kennedy family. He's been trimmed back by the Senate. He's been trimmed back by the Democratic leadership. And unfortunately, it is going to hurt his whole legacy. And probably, I think, in the presidential hopes of his wife, who I believe could have done just fine. But if you look at the news cycles, you will notice that he is more prevalent in the news than she is. He is the candidate. And they've moved to a dual co-presidency. And I think after the last 4 years of Bush-Cheney, that people don't want a co-president. They want a president. And the tone that Mr. Clinton used is just driving even supposed neutral parties to say, what is this here?
What is it, Terry, that the Kennedy family en masse is leaping on the Obama bandwagon as we speak?
Well, it tells us two things. Number one, that the Kennedy family was looking upon to see which shoulders they could bestow their legacy upon going forward. And I do believe that they genuinely believed that this was it. If John Kennedy had still been alive, I do not necessarily believe that they would have done this. But I think with his death, that they were looking for a place to place this legacy, and that they see this as the best hope for their legacy being carried forward into the 21st century. It's sort of like money. Sometimes if you don't spend it, you'll lose it. And they decided to spend their cash and spend it big on Barack Obama's future.
Do you feel you know Barack Obama?
I feel as familiar with him as anyone else who has seen him through the television screen or read about him in newspaper articles or in books. But I do, as an African-American of a particular ilk, feel that I relate to him, as many other African-Americans do, because of his bearing. He's rare in that he has not lost his essential disposition as an African-American man, and that he does not cover it up in his aesthetics or his style. So, for instance, if they ask Barack Obama, what do you think of Bill Clinton as being the first black president? He doesn't demur and say, oh, I don't know. But instead he engages and shows that he views himself very much as a black man. But he does not limit himself to being just a black man. So for somebody like me, this is the real revelation of the Invisible Man, that black men are not all one type, and we're definitely not all the type which the media projects us as being, angry, illiterate, sullen, and without erudition. This is not true. But it needed an opportunity for people to see it. It's almost as if a new model became famous and she had red hair and green eyes. Well, then every other model that had red hair and green eyes would, by proxy, increase in value. So when a Barack Obama demonstrates his personality, then people start looking for other African Americans like Barack Obama.
Take apart the South Carolina result, if you will, on one particular. Barack Obama won 24%, we are told, of the white Democrats in that primary against two white candidates. Is that a win? Is that a loss? What does it forecast about white votes in the big states in the country coming up?
Well, it says this. South Carolina is particularly balkanized racially. People know that. And with a native son, John Edwards, running, and a front runner, Hillary Clinton, for Barack Obama to come up with 24% of the white vote bodes extremely well for him in places that are not in the Deep South, California, Massachusetts, Illinois, of course, where he's going to be able to run in a way that Jesse Jackson was not, or Al Sharpton was not, able to run. When they ran understanding that they would get a certain amount of the vote and that that would provide leverage for the views and concerns of African Americans. No, Mr. Obama is not doing that. He's running to win. Each vote is contested directly between not only black candidates but white candidates. Hmm. This has never been seen before. And I say you very seldom see this in any other area. The only correlate that I might see would be Tiger Woods. And after the last two things that I've seen happen to him with the Golf Digest cover and the statements on the Golf Channel having to do with lynching and nooses, I don't even know that Tiger Woods has reached the level of acceptance in the golf world that Barack Obama has reached in terms of the American polity.
Will Smith is doing pretty well.
Yes, but Will Smith is not like Barack Obama in this. Will Smith's roles are appeasements oftentimes. Will Smith started out being a very, very humorous, modern-day version of a step and fetch it type of character in his first television show. Barack Obama never went that way. Barack Obama just said, here I am, take me as I am, these are my views, will you consider accepting me directly? And they do. So this is something new, but I believe that this may bleed over into other areas of American life. Hmm. When individuals are hiring for jobs, they're going to say, yeah, maybe this guy is just like any other guy. Because the glass ceilings of race and, of course, gender have not gone away since the 1960s. They've merely been frosted over so that they're not quite as obvious.
Hmm. Do you see a plausible transformation now?
I do, but
what does it
look
like?
Well, the first thing I see is that we're going to have a real backlash from certain social groups. Individuals who could be of any race who fear the future are going to attack the Obama campaign and the Kennedy family because this is not what they want. They thrived in balkanized situations, and there's too much love, peace, and joy in this situation for them to be able to allow it. So I expect that after we get over this first moment of euphoria, that there's going to be a great deal of negative backlash that we haven't seen the likes of since the 1960s. I do not believe that the hard right is going to take this lying down. Neither do I believe that certain factions on the left are going to take this lying down.
Mm.
That we very well may possibly see not only the politics of race, but the politics of personal destruction rear their ugly heads because this is a fundamental shift in just how individuals do business.
Bronze, explain your confidence that white America in massive numbers can embrace this beautiful brown-eyed candidate.
You just said it right there, the beautiful brown-eyed candidate. And he has shown that all African Americans, and especially for many progressive whites, it's important for them to know this, that all African Americans are not antagonized by all whites. Very often, many progressive whites who would like to embrace African-American issues or show concern are driven back by the media-created stance of the angry black man. Mr. Obama, Barack Obama's ability to push that away, to just wipe that out and to say, no, we're not that way. But in fact, we are leaders and we can lead and we're the leaders that you're looking for in many cases, has created an opening in a wall of obfuscation that no one has done before. So that man who was the invisible man is now right there in plain view. I think that they've gotten over the threats and the condescensions and the snide implications of their so-called progressive friends and have made a clean break with it. Now, will it be a 50-50? Will he get 50% of the white vote? I don't know that. I wouldn't even bet that. But will he get a good 35 to 40% in a two-person race? I really do believe it. And I believe that a good, strong showing, a 45 or 46% showing of the white vote, plus all the other constituencies that he will dominate, young voters, African-American voters, will give him a real opportunity, especially if with the Kennedy campaign they can make inroads into the Latinos and have more votes from the Latinos. So I think that people have been waiting for an individual, a black individual, who doesn't make them feel guilty, but doesn't back away at the same time from history.
You know, it is absolutely fascinating to watch him. He does refuse to take the bait under all that sort of taunting and teasing by the Clintons, and they were almost under his skin. He kept coming back to reconciliation, unity. You know, we're one country. It's almost as if he deep down believes it, is it, inhales it, lives it.
Well, the lineage of things, of movements, progressive movements from Kennedy all the way back to the unifying movement, so to speak, of Abraham Lincoln has been how do we unify and synthesize effectively as Americans at this date and time? At one time, it was through the war, and then the president's death brought the country together. The next time, it was through the 60s, a volatile time in our history, a president's death, and the country was brought together. And now we're in a very, very volatile time, unrest and war in the Middle East, an economy that is in real, real trouble, real issues in terms of American competitiveness, the loss of jobs, the impact of NAFTA on industrial America and middle America rusting away slowly. And we're looking for someone who can bring us together, unify us, and refocus us. And individuals believe that Barack Obama is that person. Now, whether he's able to do all of that or not is one question. But his ability to focus that hope is something that hasn't been seen and hasn't been seen in this unifying a way in many, many years.
Bronze, you're always interesting in completely different ways. It's such a pleasure to hear your voice and to hear it on Open Source.
Well, thank you, Christopher. It's nice to talk with you about these subjects always.
We'll do it again and again. Bronze, wherever you are, thank you. Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Join the conversation, please, with your own words online at our site, www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon, eager to hear from you.